name's Bob Darrell. I am alcoholic.
Hi, Bob!
It's a hello that'll blow your hair back, I'll tell you. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous and God's grace that I've accessed through the actions of the fellowship and the 12 steps and good sponsorship, commitments, and lots of newcomers, I haven't had a drink or any emotion or mind-altering substances since Halloween 1978. Yeah. I've found nothing that in the last little over 26 years that I've needed to do to treat my alcoholism except the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous. Even though it looked at times there was like a lot of other things that looked like would work quicker, Alcoholics Anonymous has kept me in good stead for all that time. It's really good to be here. This is a great group of enthusiastic members of AA. You don't see that everywhere. I've talked to groups that looked like cardboard cutouts. I mean, right? I mean, I think they were between medication runs. But this is a really strong group of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can tell the people here are awake. Not perfect, but awake. And that's the way my home group is. We're an awake bunch of people in action. I really want to thank the committee for having me here. It's been a great weekend. Mike has been a stellar host. Picked me up at the airport, waited. My plane was a couple hours late, waited there. I gave him a time to think deeply, which I think he needed. got in his truck, fanciest truck I ever saw. Tricked out truck. I mean, if a pimp ever drove a truck, that's the truck he would drive, I'm telling you. I never saw a truck like this. It was an amazing truck. Drove up from Fargo late Friday night. Got in late. Heard more about Mike than I ever wanted to know. Got here. It's been a good weekend. Nice basket in the room. People have been very hospitable to me. Which sometimes I'll tell you something, even though I still, after all these years, still have remnants of the way of that low self-esteem that I've always had. It's like sometimes I catch myself feeling emotionally when people treat me well and like they treat me like they're glad to see me, like I want to look around and see who they're talking to, right? Because I still have remnants of that feeling that I came in here with, that feeling of coming from behind. That feeling of not measuring up. I heard some speakers this weekend that were great. Jeff was Friday. I really enjoyed him. I really liked. See here, or Saturday. Saturday. Yeah, there you go. Enjoy your sense of humor, which doesn't speak well of my mental health. But I really, really enjoyed your sense of humor. And Mary, I really enjoyed your talk. I listened very carefully, and I really got something that was very clear to me. You shouldn't drink. Drinking's bad for you. That's a bad deal. I'm glad you're sober. A sober thing seems to be working out good for you. My sponsor, Saturday night, I always love hearing him. I can't hear him enough. I probably heard him, oh, my God, 40 or 50 times. I don't even know how many times. And we're both very busy guys in AA, and it's always a great thing when we get to hang out a little bit together. And recently we've been together a lot, and which is to my delight. And then last night I got stuck on a hot seat with a bunch of guys that were asking me every question that I've asked myself over the years. It was amazing. I could have been in that audience asking those questions. And you know what that spoke to me is that I really got it that I was in the middle of a group of people who understand the two prongs of our primary purpose, that's what their life was about, not only just to stay sober, but also to help the other alcoholic, because a lot of those questions were about concern about some of the new guys that come in here and how do we help some of these guys that are hard to help. And I knew that I was in a group that was like-minded to my home group. My home group's really about our primary purpose. We know that we don't delude ourselves, even though that there are members of my group that are very successful, well-off people. We do not delude ourselves that God got us sober so we'll have great lives. That's a byproduct, but we know that we got sober because we were given a purpose. We were plucked from the abyss and given a purpose, and the purpose is to help other alcoholics who suffer like we suffer. And the wonderful thing about that for me is that when I get that, all of a sudden everything in my life makes sense. All the horrible things I struggled with, all the things I did that I was so disgusted with myself and ashamed of, all of a sudden all of that makes sense and becomes useful in trying to help a guy that just walked in the door that is convinced that he's gone too far, that no one will ever understand that his case is different, and I'm destroyed and broken worse than you are. And then all my experience can tell you, no, you're not. How much we are alike, how much we come from the same place. I didn't come from an alcoholic home. I know a lot of times in Alcoholic Anonymous meetings you hear people talk about there's terrible childhoods that they had, as if there's an implication that the alcoholism came from that. And I don't think that's the case, because I came from a home that where my parents weren't alcoholics. My parents loved me. I often sat in the early days in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and listened to people talk about their tragic childhoods and how they were mistreated, and often envious. Like, I wished I had somebody to hang my weirdness on, but I was loved and taken care of as a kid, and I still turned out like awful. And I just think I had a propensity to be the way I am, a hunger and a yearning and a incompleteness that drove me before I ever picked up a drink. I was a driven little kid. I was a driven kid in grade school. I was the guy that whatever I had, it wasn't it. I was restless, irritable, and discontent as far back as I can remember. I'm the kid that at Christmas gets all these incredible presents, and then within no time at all, the shine is worn off every one of them, right? And now what's next? What's next? And it's almost as if I have this insatiable hole within me that the more I try to fill it, it doesn't fill. The hole just gets bigger. And I'm stretching it out to infinity, and I can't seem to... I'm never satisfied. I never seem to be settled or fit anywhere. When Silkworth says that guys like me are restless, irritable, and discontent unless we can again experience the ease and comfort I'd once found in alcohol, I was that way before I ever found the ease and comfort in alcohol. There was something wrong with my spirit. I didn't feel the way other people looked. I seemed to have an inability to mix with you the way I so often saw you able to mix with each other. And so I become the pretend human being. I'm the guy who tries to mimic you and walking around all the time with an anxiousness about being found out, as if someone someday is going to see through the facade and know that I'm a phony human being, that I ain't anything that I'm showing you, that I'm something else that I don't want you to see because I don't like it. And I am absolutely convinced that if you really knew about me, you would feel about me the way I feel about me. And the truth was, I wasn't very big on me. When I was 12 years old, I drank for the first time, and I didn't drink to drink. I just was with a bunch of kids that were older than me. They were the tough kids in our neighborhood. They were the kids that were always in and out of juvie. They were like 14, 15. The oldest kid was 16 years old, and they were the kids with the black leather jackets and the switchblades. They were the kids that had power. You know, that kind of power when they'd walk down the halls in school or at the football games, people would move out of their way. And when you're secretly weak and pathetic and inadequate like I am, man, those guys had what I wanted. if I could have that kind of power. And so I'm hanging around with these kids, but I'm always coming from behind. I'm always the guy that no matter what I do, it doesn't seem to measure up. Nothing I can do really brings me to a place where I feel like them. So I'm the coming from behind driven kid. And one day we pull a burglary in the neighborhood where I live. We broke into somebody's house, and one of the things we stole was some bottles of whiskey. And I didn't know anything about it. I'd never seen my parents drunk. All I knew about it really was that it was for adults. I don't, you know something, looking back, I don't even know that if I got it that it made you high or not. I don't even think I got that. I didn't have any experience with it. I'd never seen anybody drunk. I don't know. But what I do know is I want to fit with these kids. And when you're coming from behind and you're a pretend human being, you watch people. And you watch them and you become a mimic. So when they're passing around this quart bottle of Seagram 7, and what I'm seeing is that the bigger hit you take off the bottle, the more attention you get from the other guys. So by the time it gets to me, I'm in. I don't know. I'm just glad it wasn't. I would have drank whatever. I'm glad it wasn't cat urine. I would have been in for anything, because I want their approval. And I took a big hit off this quart bottle of Seagram 7, and I'll tell you, I felt like my insides were on fire. It was awful. And then after a couple minutes, the burning stopped, and something happened to me that would change the course of my life. I started to feel so good and so a part of and so integrated with those kids. For the first time, I could come out and play. For the first time in my life, I could just relax around them, and I felt like they looked, and I never felt like anybody else looked. And alcohol, it made me feel so good that the way I was going to be without it from that moment on would never be enough for me again. And when you're 12 and 13 and 14 years old, 15 years old, you can't drink every day, but I drank every chance I could get. And I lived for it. It's how the effects of that was the thing that I yearned for. It was the thing that I shoplifted for. It was the thing that I acted tough for. It was the thing I smoked cigarettes for. It was the thing I drank initially for. Something that awoke in my spirit and allowed me to integrate myself and be a part of, to be able to fit with you. And when you've gone through your whole life in that state that Bill Wilson talks about, he calls it anxious apartness, and you're lonely, and you that separation thing, man, something that overcomes that's the thing I've been looking for all my life. But I'm an alcoholic, and I don't know it, and I got that phenomenon of craving. I got that allergic reaction to alcohol. I had that from the first drink. I have never taken a social drink in my life. I have never had the experience once that non-alcoholics, Al-Anons, people who don't have this disease have all the time. And that's been sitting at a party, maybe drinking and smoking stuff, or at a bar drinking and been drinking for an hour or so, and have the bartender come by and say, "Bob, would you like another drink?" I have never once sat there and thought honestly to myself, "Nah, this is just right." Not once. Not once. I never get, but you know what I get? I get so close to just right, it makes me crazy. I get a feeling and a sense of urgency that I'm about to be just right, maybe on the next drink. So I'm that guy that drank, I'm a driven drinker. I'm the guy if I got a bottle of whiskey and it's half gone, I'm already planning getting the next one. I'm the guy that's got to keep it coming because I'm almost going to touch magnificence. It's just beyond my fingertips. And there were times in early drinking where I got so close that it was magic. I think from my experience and talking to a lot of people, I think for alcoholics of my type, I think there was a time in my early drinking before the disease progressed and turned on me when alcohol on some kind of level created a spiritual awakening or experience within me. I remember, there are people, I've said that in meetings, and people have bad-rapped that and said, it's just an illusion. I'll tell you something, I don't think it is. I remember times when I would walk into places and I would start drinking. I remember walking into parties and dances, locked up inside myself, just feeling like I'm dying here. And after a few drinks, man, I could come out and play. After about 7 drinks, I get that feeling like I love everybody. I love you, man. You remember that feeling? I remember times with the guys I hung around with where I'd feel so connected and a part of it, almost bring tears to my eyes. The feeling of camaraderie. I would drink in those days, and I'll tell you, I could shoot pool better than I could ever shoot pool. I could dance, and I can't dance. I could be funny and sober. I'm not a funny guy. Sober, I'm stupid, boring, and glum. But half lit up, man, I could come out and play. I could be funny. I could be deep. Remember 3 a.m. deep? Remember deep? Cracking the secrets of the universe. I'd say stuff that would blow my mind. You know? Wow. I could talk to girls. I'll tell you something, if it wasn't for alcohol, I'd be celibate to this day. I'd have never, ever gotten anything going with a woman. I just couldn't. I remember junior high school. I went to a dance, sober, stuck up against that wall, watching everybody dance. There was a girl in my class I had a crush on. I remember watching her thinking, God, I'm going to ask her to dance. I'm going to ask her to dance. Not now, not next song, next song, next song, next song, come, next song. Finally, a half hour of that crap, I finally mustered up enough courage. I walked across that long gymnasium, got over to her to ask her to dance, and she turned me down. I remember walking that 7 or 8 miles back across that gymnasium, everybody felt like everybody in there is looking at me, and everybody's thinking, what a pathetic loser he is. And I remember walking over there and slinking in that corner just till I couldn't take it and I had to bolt out of that place. I'm telling you, if it wouldn't have been for alcohol, I'd never tried that again. But not too long later, I'm at a dance and under the power of 151 rum and Coca-Cola, and I could ask anybody to dance. And girls would dance with me because I had a confidence about me. There was the awkwardness was gone. I wasn't the creepy guy anymore that just made you look like, what's wrong with him? I had a smoothness about me. And if someone turned me down, I could walk away with them and know within inside myself beyond a shadow of a doubt that, boy, are they missing something. And what a tremendous transformation that is for a guy like me. Tremendous. But as alcoholism, unfortunately, is a progressive illness, and what that means, in my experience, is it's a disease of diminishing returns. In the beginning of my drinking, there was a tremendous amount of ease and comfort, a tremendous amount of effect. It was as if alcohol put me in some kind of zone that connected me to some flow of energy in the universe where everything was just clicking. And it was awesome. But as the years progressed, my ability to achieve those effects diminished and diminished and diminished. And at the same time, in my desperate, frantic effort to achieve those effects, the futile effort, the price I'm paying for continuing this is going up and up and up. And it was almost as if when I drank, every time I'd go on a run, it was like spinning a roulette wheel. And on that roulette wheel in the early days, there was dancing and drag racing and jam sessions with the guys and singing a cappella music and shooting pool and roughhousing and laughing and carrying on and getting laid and partying, a little bit of throwing up occasionally, a little bit of going to jail once in a while. But really, for the most part, yeah, I'd spin that wheel and come up party. But as the years progressed, some sadistic force moved into my life as the disease progressed and started changing the things on that wheel and putting up more jails and wet pants and broken noses and blackouts. Oh, my God, I was a blackout. Any blackout drinkers in here? Oh, yeah. My people. It's tough going through life when other people know more about you than you do. It's that's a hard deal. And I never did anything good in a blackout. Nobody ever came up to me the next day and said, "Oh, Bob, you were so helpful last night. You peed in our kitchen. You hit on my wife, you broke my lamp, you stole my stash, you sideswiped my car, you passed out on my front lawn. You told everybody at the party last night you beat Bruce Lee in a karate match." Boy, you hear that stuff the next day, I just want to die. I couldn't get drunk quick enough. And I became the guy that started drinking because I was drinking. I needed to drink, and it fueled my alcoholism. And as the disease progressed more and more, more horrible and horrible things happened to me. And the harder it was to stay sober, the more uncomfortable abstinence would become, and the more awful drinking was becoming. And it's a tragic thing. I think one of the worst things that alcoholism ever did to me is over the years is it ground away my life. I finally got to a point where I'm thinking about killing myself and there's nothing left of any value within me or without me. And at that point, not only am I reduced to nothing, but the disease has pulled the plug on the party. And I entered into that stage, the last stages of chronic alcoholism, that stage where most of us die. And it's not from anything you think. It's not the worst part of alcoholism is I get to a place that it talks about in A Vision for You where I can't live with it and I can't live without it. I get to a place where I know a loneliness such as few do. The book says I'll be at the jumping off place and I'll wish for the end. And I got to that place that no matter what I drank or took or the drugs I threw into the mix to try to keep the party going, I couldn't jumpstart the party. And now I've become the kind of drinker who I drink by myself, even when I'm around a whole lot of people. I'm by myself. And I feel sorry for myself, and I go on crying jags, and I'm pitiful. This is not a party. This is awful. And I get to the point where I don't care anymore about myself or my hygiene, and people don't want to be around me, and fine, because I don't want to be around you anymore, because I feel you just, everything that you are just points out in stark relief how wrong I am in here. I don't know what's wrong, but something's wrong. And the only thing I've ever known that seemed to overcome that and give me a sense of integration, of feeling that I was a part of, doesn't work anymore. And I don't know why it doesn't work. And so I get sober over and over and over again. And I get sober over and over again because every time I enter into a state of abstinence, something happens to me that I don't understand, is that I start to get sick of spirit. And people, well-meaning people in institutions, from the time I was a late teenager till I finally got sober in 1978 for 7 years, kept telling me that alcohol and combinations of alcohol and drugs was my problem. And there were times when I wanted to believe that, because I could see that the arrests are as a result of that. I could see that I'm in detox as a result of that. I could see that I'm having seizures as a result of that. I could see that I lost this stuff as a result of that. But that's really not the problem, really. And I knew that with everything in me. And I knew that because I would get sober over and over and over again. And something is really wrong with me when I'm sober, and I don't understand what it is. But I don't fit very well sober. And I'm prone to look to these depressions sober that I don't understand, and they just overwhelm me. I'm prone to fits of anxiety where I just spin in my head almost to the degree of panic. And I go to these AA meetings and I pretend. I go to the AA meetings and I try to act like I look like you people look. And it's awful. I know what it's like to sit in the middle of an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, being surrounded by people that I understand intellectually care about me and want to help me, and feeling so distant and apart from you. I used to have this feeling, I'd sit there so removed, a feeling like as if it's all of you and then there's me in this state of anxious apartness. And the only thing that ever overcame that doesn't work anymore was five shots of Jose Cuervo. And the problem is now I'm in a stage of alcoholism that's bleak and Jose Cuervo doesn't work anymore. On my second to last run, I got arrested for a hit and run DUI in a stolen car. It wasn't really stolen, but they borrowed it. And I ended up in a county jail cell and I'm facing 2 years in a state penitentiary. And I'm at one of the low points in my life. I remember they gave me a phone call. And I can't even describe the sick feeling I had when I realized that there was no one I could call. My parents loved me. But I'll tell you something. I pushed them and forced them into a position where they wouldn't have anything to do with me for their own survival. Because I gave them such an emotional battering over the years. And one of the things I did to them is I would get back up on my feet and they would get their hopes up that I was going to be okay. And then 6 months or 6 weeks later, I've trashed their hopes one more time. And I did that to them for years. So they just couldn't take it anymore. But I'll tell you, it never sat well with them. My mother, who's not an alcoholic, was seeing a therapist and taking tranquilizers because she could never really get away from the anxiety of caring about her son. My father slept 15 or 16 hours a day because of what was going on with me. I didn't have a girlfriend to call. I guess I would have liked to have had a girlfriend, but it's hard to get a relationship going when you're homeless. What do you say? I mean, you want to come back to the TV room in the halfway house? There's not a lot of panache in that. I mean, really? I don't have any running partners. There was no one to call. I tried calling bail bondsmen. But, you know, they want you to have like an address and a job and all that stuff. I don't have any of that stuff. So I sat in that county jail cell for close to a half a year waiting to go to trial. And in that time, I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in there, and not because I want to recover from alcoholism or I wanted what... I kind of wanted what you want, actually, is the reason I went there. And what you had that I wanted is you had cigarettes. And I knew that the people in Alcoholics Anonymous would have cigarettes, and I had a tremendous cigarette addiction, and they used to... The state would, or the county or whatever, would give us that Bull Durham and that, you know, we'd roll it, and that stuff's awful. And you guys had tailor-made cigarettes. And I knew from past experience, from being around Alcoholics Anonymous for years in institutions, that some of the people in AA were wealthy and very well connected, and I had a little hope that maybe I'll find someone that would go my bail or know a judge or something. You know, I'm always got an angle. I'm always the guy that's shooting the angles because it's all about me. And I go to this AA meeting, and I'm sitting in the room waiting for the do-gooders from Alcoholics Anonymous to come in here and tell us how wonderful their life is. Oh my God, it's hell. And here comes this guy Woody, and I didn't want to see Woody. Woody is the last guy I want to see. Woody is one of those kind of guys that I can, if I'm doing better, I can kind of tolerate him, but I ain't doing very good right now. Woody's one of those happy, grateful for everything members of Alcoholics Anonymous that talks about God and the steps. And, you know, one of those guys that just, when you're doing really bad, make your skin crawl. You know what I mean? One of those guys, you know, just, oh, man, not Woody. And here he comes, that big smile and, you know, all eyes and teeth and just, you know, he's just coming at me. And, oh, man, here he comes. And I just shake his hand and I go into my spiel. I tell him, I said, oh, Woody, I'm so sorry I let you and all the guys in AA down. And, you know, as if Alcoholics Anonymous has gone into mourning because I drank again, you know. I said, I'm going to beat this. I'm going to get out of here. Boy, if you could help me or one of your friends, I'd sure appreciate it. I got to get out, get an attorney and get out and get bail. And I'm going to get into a good halfway house, not like that one that took advantage of me. I'm going to get into a good one, and I'm going to get some of that. I'm going to go to the government. I'm going to get some of that Volk rehab money. I know there's that money's available. I'm going to go back to school, and I'm going to make something of myself, and maybe I'll be a doctor, an attorney, and I'll – and he's looking at me funny, and I said, I knew something was wrong, and I said, and I'm going to go to your meetings and work your stairs and do all that stuff. And Woody looks at me, and he's shaking his head, and he says, kid, who are you trying to kid? You're not going to stay sober. Kid, you haven't hit a bottom. You're not done. You haven't surrendered. Who are you kidding, kid? And I stood there, and I didn't say nothing to him because I don't like confrontation sober. But I'm my head screaming at him, and I'm thinking to myself, who the hell are you to say that to me? You don't know nothing about me. I don't need that negative stuff. I need positive reinforcement here. I don't need that negative stuff. You with your, what do you mean, haven't hit a bottom? What do you mean, haven't surrendered? You with your big Cadillac and your house and your kids and your good job, you don't know nothing about me. You don't know enough. Surrender. Surrender what? What? There's nothing left of me. 2 years ago, I had something to surrender. I had a job and a girlfriend. I had some stuff I could. There's nothing left of me. But I didn't say any of that. I just glared at him. And I went to the meeting and sat there, and I didn't hear nothing in that meeting because I'm just grinding away in my head of the things I should say to him, you know, to explain it to him how wrong he is. And I went back to my cell that night, and I ground away in my head about him, and I hated him. And I want you to know that Woody was absolutely right. Woody could see something in me I've saw in probably 1,000 guys over the years in detoxes and in the county jail and in the prisons, in the heart of my Alcoholics Anonymous program. He saw a guy that was dying of alcoholism, insisting on having his hands on the wheel of his own ship, insisting on it. And see, I'm dying of alcoholism because I can't give up the one thing. The one, really, the only thing. You can give up this. If you can give this one thing up, you don't have to lose nothing else. But I can't give up the one thing. Some people never give it up. Some people give it up early. They give it up when they're still making $100,000 a year and they're living in nice houses and they've never been to jail and they've never lost nothing. And they give it up. They surrender the one thing. And their life changes so dramatically that they never have to be like they were again. And then there are other guys like me who lose everything until I'm stripped to the bone and I still can't give it up. So, and there's guys like me that go past that and we die of alcoholism because we can't give up the one thing. And we die like friends of mine who have put pistols to their head and blown their brains out. Or we drink till we pass out and then we throw up while we passed out and we drowned in our own vomit. And I've watched a lot of guys die of alcoholism over the years, and it's awful. Because by the time, it's such a slow, tedious process as alcoholism grinds away your life that by the time it kills you, you have wished you were dead for a long time. By the time it kills you, everybody you've ever loved or wanted their approval hates you, and they're going to be real glad you're dead. I can't imagine a lonelier, more emotionally distraught way to die than of alcoholism. And I couldn't give up the one thing. I didn't know what the one thing was for a long time. The one thing is my self-reliance, my will. I'm one of those kind of guys, I can turn my life over to God all day long, and if I retain my will, it's a useless proposition. Because if you retain your will, and my will is really my judgment. I had an attorney, as I was making a will, tell me that one day. He said, you know what you're doing when you're making your last will? You're really making your last judgment. You're judging these people to be okay, they're going to get something. You're judging these people to be idiots, they get nothing. Your will is your judgment. And I thought about it, and I was the guy, I'm the guy that can go on a run and alcohol will strip me to the bone. I end up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and the first thing I get back is my opinion and my judgment. and I'm the guy who is dying of alcoholism, and yes, I want help, and let me explain the kind of help I want you to give me. It's hard to get people in AA to cooperate. It's really hard to get them to go along with that. Because I'm still the great I am. I'm the guy who still knows. I'm dying of alcoholism, but I know. And I can't surrender my will. And it's a futile proposition trying to turn my life over to God. Because if you do that and you retain your judgment and you want to be the guy who knows, then God, here's my life, and be patient, God. There's a list coming of how it should go. Because I'm still in charge. I went before a judge. He sentenced me to 2 years in a state penitentiary. Stayed the commitment. Gave me a break. Put me in a place called the Ark House. It was the only place left that would take me because I'd been in every treatment center in western Pennsylvania. And this wasn't really a treatment center. It was more of a, it was like a mission, really. It housed about 200 guys like me that were dying of alcoholism. And I went into that place with a determination not to drink because I don't want to do the 2 years. I'm required to get good UAs, good PO report, make the restitutions, all that stuff. And the judge said, if you can do that, you come back before me in a year. And if you've done everything and you're cool for a year, we'll reduce this to a misdemeanor. If not, it's a felony and you go do 2 years in a state penitentiary. So I'm in this place and I'm trying not to drink. But I'm the guy that talks about in the big book. No matter how tremendous my resolve is to not drink, the emotions of untreated alcoholism gradually grind away that resolve. If you're an alcoholic of my type, the question is not if you're going to drink again. With untreated alcoholism, it is the question is when. And you can throw stuff at it and prolong it for weeks and months and sometimes years. But if you're a real alcoholic, an alcoholic of the type it talks about in the big book, with untreated alcoholism, without God's grace, without those steps, without helping other people, without a sponsor, the next drink's coming. You can slow it down, but it's coming. And because of that, my lack of power, I'm hanging on by my fingernails. And I tell you something, I was under an illusion for a lot of years that I would hit the ultimate bottom, that I would get to a place where I would want to stay sober badly enough, and then I would be able to do it. But for a lot of years, I just wasn't there yet. And now I'm in a place where I really want to stay sober because it's not fun anymore, and it's killing me, and I'm facing 2 years in prison, and I don't want to live like that anymore. I want to change. I really want to change. But lack of power is my dilemma. I don't have what it takes to change. Isn't it awful when you're in a spot where you know your life's in line, you have to change, and then you realize you can't? It seems so unfair. And I'm in this place, and I'm hanging on, but I can't overcome my alcoholism. And I'm going to a lot of meetings, and if going to meetings was a treatment for alcoholism, I suppose that would be my sobriety date. But I'm getting sicker and sicker in here. I'm becoming more restless, irritable, discontent. I'm battling with depression and anxiety. Awful, awful feelings of loneliness. And I don't know what's wrong with me. And this restless, irritable, and discontent thing that Silkworth talks about that always brings me back to yearning for that sense of ease and comfort. The thing that activates the obsession with alcohol. I mean, my obsession with alcohol is never with alcohol. My obsession is with the effect of alcohol. And when I feel restless, irritable, and discontent, it just starts gnawing on me. You know what it's very, very much like is I saw this in a movie where there's the communists had captured an American spy and they were going to torture secrets out of this guy. So they're beating him with rubber hoses for days and he won't give nothing up. This is a tough spy. And finally, after days of beating this guy with rubber hoses, they bring in this little old Chinese doctor. And he comes in and he bows and he says, "Oh, you tell me everything." And the spy says, "Yeah, I'm not going to tell you nothing, doc. Go ahead, do whatever you want. You want to put electrodes on me? You want to beat me some more? Go ahead." He says, "No, we not beat you. We drop a drop of water on your forehead every few seconds. And the guy says, you think you beat me with rubber hoses for days? You think a drop of water is going to make me tell you something? Hit me with a bucket of water. Go ahead. The guy says, no, not a bucket, just one drop. And he starts to drip into the water as the guy's tied there on the guy's forehead. And the guy's laughing. Yeah, go ahead. Hit me with another one. But after about a week, he'll tell him anything to get it to stop. And my alcoholism's like that on some low level. And the thing that's deceiving about this spiritual malady is it goes right below the horizon. It goes right below the radar, and this restless, irritable, and discontent is often something I can't really put my finger on or see. It's just a low-level gnawing within my spirit. And I'm the guy that no matter how tremendous my resolve is to not drink again, my alcoholism will gradually gnaw away at that resolve. Until one day it gets down to the bone, and I got a screw-it switch in my head. When the screw-it switch goes, I'm going. And I drank again. And I had busted out of that place, and I was on the run, running from the cops, and now I'm living in an abandoned building in a park, and I don't know what to do, and my life's over. So with a bottle of Richard's Wild Irish Rose, I walked out onto a bridge for the purpose of taking my own life. And I walked out of there just because I couldn't go on like this anymore. This is awful. And I'll tell you, I am not a suicidal guy. I'm sometimes a homicidal guy, but I'm not a suicidal guy. I've made fun of suicidal guys. I think they're wimpy guys. But I'm a suicidal guy now, and I'm a suicidal guy now because you put a guy like me in a position where drinking is awful and sobriety is awful, suicide will start looking like a good idea to a guy like me. And I'm standing on this bridge trying to get up enough courage to jump and just stop this. And I break down and I start sobbing because I'm a coward. And I don't have what it takes to jump. And I remember hammering my fist on this piece of metal on that bridge till I sprained or broke my hand and it swelled up. And I never felt so pitiful in my life. And if you'd have come along and you would have said to me, Bob, what's wrong with you? Is it alcoholism? Nah. Wasn't alcoholism. I thought it was some kind of mental illness or something, but I'd been to therapists and I tried medications and I tried everything and nothing seemed to work for me. I wouldn't have believed it was alcoholism. If I would have been honest with you, I might have told you I felt like I was dying of loneliness because I don't fit anywhere drunk and I don't fit anywhere sober and it's killing me. And all I want to do is feel good again. And I can't get it back. And I couldn't kill myself, and little did I know that was going to be my last run. Little did I know that I was about to be, as Bill says in the book, rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence. I didn't know what the, it's funny, it's a little sidebar. I didn't know what the fourth dimension was. I was sponsoring a guy 20 years ago or so. It was a scientist and a teacher. And I said, Rob, what's the fourth dimension? And he said, for years, science thought there were only three dimensions, the dimension of height, width, and depth. And then he said there were some physicists, scientists that came along, started to postulate that there was actually four dimensions. And the fourth dimension is time. And Einstein was one of the people that started to believe that the fourth dimension was time, that this book's so many inches high, so many inches thick, so many inches wide, a certain time, and then it changes. Because the universe is fluid and in motion. And I said to him, as a self-centered alcoholic, well, that's just great. What the hell does that have to do with me? And he said, well, maybe you've lived most of your life in the past or the future. And maybe if you were to enter the fourth dimension, you would hear a loud pop as your head came out of your butt, and you'd actually show up in your life. And when he said that to me, all of a sudden I understood what my first sponsor and some of the old timers would tell me in AA when I was new. I would go to my sponsor just insane. And I would start telling him what's wrong. And I'm going to lose my apartment and the things at work. And he'd start saying, but right this moment, Is everything okay? Well, but by next week. And he said, no. Right this moment? Right now? Is everything? Well, yeah, but you don't understand. He says, right this moment, is everything all right? Well, yeah. He says, good. When it's no longer all right this moment, we got something to deal with. It was like some kind of trick, right? And what he's trying to do, he's trying to bring me to God. Because it tells you in chapter 5, the place you'll find God. It says, there is one who has all power. May you find him in a place few of us ever visit. May you find him now. Even as I'm saying that, some of you aren't even here. You're in your head thinking, I wonder what he means by that. And I can't wait to tell so-and-so that. And when I get back to the home, I'll tell that. You're not even here right now when I'm saying that. You're up here. Disconnected. And it's no wonder self-centered guys like me don't feel like we fit out here in the world, because the truth is I'm not out here in the world. I'm up in here in this one. I'm totally self-consumed, self-involved. I was sitting in that detox, my first sponsor and members of a group that back in those days were probably the most active group in Las Vegas in Alcoholics Anonymous, brought a meeting in there twice a week, and they would come and pick guys like me up that were willing to go to the outside meetings and take us to their home group. And I got a sponsor and I started going to their meetings, and for the first time in 7 years of sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, something was different with me. And I didn't understand it till for a long time, but I sat there, and as you shared about yourself, I caught myself inside myself nodding my head and thinking, my God, I'm like that. I've felt like that. I've drank like that. I have failed like that. And yet I watched you, and I watched you closely, and I saw that you were different. There was something about you that I envied and didn't understand. And it what it was is that you were sober and you were happy. They seemed like mutually exclusive positions to me. Sort of like military intelligence. They don't exist in the same frame. I could imagine sober and I could imagine happy. I just couldn't imagine sober and happy. To me, Alcoholics Anonymous had good news and bad news. The good news, if I went to thousands of these stupid meetings, I'd stay sober the rest of my life. And the bad news is I'm going to live a long time, because I can't imagine life without it. And you guys were happy and you laughed a lot. And some of you were successful. God, my first sponsor had a house on a hill with tennis courts. I never knew anybody that had and he was a skid row bum who hitchhiked around the country, hopped freight trains. And he had a house with tennis courts. How do you do that? How do you go from you can't even get a job to having a house with tennis courts? How do you go from being the guy that's so depressed that he should be locked up somewhere to be the guy that's in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and he's laughing and carrying on and having a good time? How do you go from there to there? God knows I've wanted to be that guy. I've done everything I could do to be that guy, and I can't be that guy. And these guys were like me, and they had made the turn. And out of that came some hope that, my God, maybe if I did everything that they did, maybe what happened for them could happen to me. And I made a commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous, and a guy told me when I was new I had a lot of problems. I had going to jail problems. I had police problems, family problems, emotional problems, mental problems, financial problems, employment problems. And he said to me, he said, listen, kid, none of that stuff's any of your business. He said, if you got one thing and one thing only to concern yourself with, and that's recovery from alcoholism in the program and fellowship Alcoholics Anonymous. And he made me a promise. He says, kid, I promise you, if you will make Alcoholics Anonymous the center of your life. He said, you know that place within you that drinking occupied, where it just dominated your life? You were either drinking or you're thinking about drinking. He said, if you put Alcoholics Anonymous in that place in your life, things will change for you. And all of this stuff will clear up in time. And I remember when he said that to me, I just thought to myself, what the hell? I don't got a plan. I don't know how I'm going to think. I can't figure my way out. I don't know how I'm going to stay out of prison. I don't know how I'm ever going to get a job. I don't know how I'm going to get out of this halfway house. I don't know how I'm ever going to make myself feel better and have a good time. I don't know how I'm going to change any of it. So maybe I'll just try what he says. What do I got to lose? And I did exactly what he said. I started going to a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. A guy told me when I was new, he said, if there's a meeting going on anywhere in town and you don't have to be somewhere else, be there. Get there early, shake some hands, listen. Stop thinking. Listen. And then stay after the meeting and talk to some people about what you heard there. And I started doing that, and I got this sponsor, and I started going through the steps. And I'll tell you something, my first 10 years of sobriety, when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous really young, and I know there's a lot of young people here, I never grew up, I never had a checking account, I never paid taxes, I never had nothing, I never had an apartment in my name. I had all my growing up happen in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know how to go to work. You guys had to teach me how to go to work. Simple principles like do what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it. Show up where you're supposed to show up. If you give your word, stick to it. And if you give your word and later realized it was a mistake, stick to it anyway because you said you were going to do it. And I started this process of trying to clear up the wreckage of my past. And I want to talk a little bit about amends. When I was new, I would sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and hear people talking about making amends. And it would terrify me. It would horrify me. And I could see how it was a good thing for you guys to make amends. But, you know, I'm not like you. You know, I could tell you probably said something when you were drunk to your wife that was unkind. You should make amends. Good for you. Build your character. Maybe you stole a little money from where you work or you padded your expense account. You should make that right. But I lived like an animal on the streets. There's a guy to this day that I've hired detectives trying to find. One time he was my best friend, and in a blackout I took a hunting knife with a blade, a buffalo skinner knife with a blade about this long, and I opened up his chest, and he'll never be the same. There were people that went to prison as a result of me. My mom and dad, I knew I could never make amends to them. I'd gone too far. But the people in Alcoholics Anonymous didn't care what I thought. And they said, we're going to do these actions anyway. And one of the first things they had me do was they had me start writing notes and little letters to my mom. And I thought, it's not going to do any good. And they said, just do it anyway. And we want you to call your mom and don't call or collect. Remember, I'll never forget this first phone call. I said, Mom, how you doing? She says, Rob's that you? I said, yeah, Mom. She says, are you in Pennsylvania? I said, no, Mom, I'm in Nevada. But the operator didn't come on and ask me to pay for the call. No, I paid for the call. You paid for the call? She couldn't believe it. I always called collect. My parents were the welfare state or something, you know. I had a sense of entitlement, you know. They owe me for bringing me into this lousy world against my will. They owed me. And you guys encouraged me to start taking actions that were different than anything I'd ever taken with them. And I started writing them letters, and I started sending them pictures. When I was a year sober, My family didn't believe that I was really sober. Because, you know, one of the worst things I did is I kept telling them I've straightened out and then I hadn't. You know, I'd lie to them over and over. And I'm talking to them on the phone. They said, we're going to come out to Las Vegas. We've never seen Las Vegas. And they're coming out to see me, but they're coming out with an attitude of, you know, he's probably a bum. He's probably conning us. But, hey, if we get out there and he's conning us, we've never been to Vegas. It's not a total loss. I mean, right? Right? So they fly out to Las Vegas, and they're staying at the Stardust Hotel. And I took them out to dinner with my first sponsor and his wife. I took them to my home group. And they saw me when I was with you. And I've never been better than when I'm with you. And I tell you, my parents loved going to Amy's. They wanted to go every day. After a few days, I didn't offer to take them to a meeting. They called me up. They said, aren't we going to a meeting today? I said, well, I thought, you know, you're not alcoholics. I thought maybe it'd be boring to you. No, we really want to go. They loved AA. My mom and dad would sit there, and they'd laugh like hell. They never heard anything so funny as some of the stuff we shared. And then I remember watching them across the room one time, some guys in the meeting talking about getting his kids back, and they're tearing up. Oh, this is great. They just loved Alcoholics Anonymous. The last day, the day before they left, I had my amends list, and I owed my father a lot of money. You know, when the times when I was going to go to jail, and he paid my fines for me and loaned me the money, or I was going to be out in the streets again, and he loaned me the money to pay the rent, and he did that for years. And it was a lot of money. I mean, it was such a large amount of money. I figured it out. It was going to take me 12 and a half years to pay him back. And I had a game plan. As they told me to AA, they say you make a plan. And they say you sold your integrity a nickel and a dime at a time, and you're going to buy it back a nickel and a dime at a time. And I had my payment plan. I sat down in the Stardust coffee shop with my mom and dad, and I told them what I'm trying to do. I said, I want to pay you back this money I borrowed off you. And here's my plan. And they looked at each other, and they kind of smiled, and they were holding hands. And my father says to me, he says, Rob, we don't want you to pay the money back. He said, we don't know what this AA thing's all about, really, but I'll tell you, this is the first time in years we've ever had any hope that you were going to be okay. Something's different about you. And I don't know what it is, but whatever it is, I want you to keep, just don't forget about the money. Just keep doing this AA thing. And that just that's all we want you to do. And man, I walked away from there. I'm on cloud nine. I'm thinking, I like this amends stuff, man. This is good. It was like hitting the lottery. And I'm on my way to my sponsor's office to tell him the good news. And on the way, I'm thinking about other people I owe money to, if I could get them to see the light, like I got my parents to see the light. And I get to my sponsor's office, and I'm telling him, hey, my dad says I don't have to pay him. Isn't this great? My sponsor says, it doesn't matter what your dad says. It's your debt. You owe him. You got to find a way to pay him. I thought, what? He says, really? This is not about your dad. This is about you and your integrity. You had borrowed that money. You got to pay it back. I said, well, I can't. He won't take it. He told me he wouldn't. If I send him a check every month, he's not going to use it. He doesn't need the money, really. He said, you got to find a way. And if God will provide the wherever, he will make it possible. I said, all right, but I don't know how I'm going to do this. He said, just trust me. God will show you a way. I was working for a little over minimum wage at a store as a cashier. My father had one hobby. It was almost an obsession with him. He collected coins, old silver coins and silver certificates and the old gold certificates and war nickels and wheat pennies and all that stuff. I'd just sit at the kitchen table for hours with those books and putting those coins in those books and making catalogs of everything he had in his coin collection. He loved that stuff. And I'm working as a cashier back in the late 70s, and every single day, I get silver coins and war nickels and silver certificates are coming through that register. And I thought to myself one day, maybe I could start saving this stuff for my dad. And I went to my boss and I said, do you mind if I buy this stuff out of the register, if I could put it aside and then when I get paid, buy it? And he said, boss said, I don't care. I don't save that stuff. And I started saving rare coins and old silver coins and silver certificates. And it took me, it's a funny thing, this amends thing. When I start paying the money back, and start heading in the direction of making it right, all of a sudden the universe becomes a very friendly place. And I started getting raises and bonuses. There was a guy in my AA group that had a moving business. He used to pay me $100 cash for a couple hours work helping him move furniture. And what would have taken 12 and a half years, in about 4 years, I saved up at face value in old silver coins and silver certificates what I owed my father. And I was able to give that to him. And I was able to give it to him knowing he would take that. He wouldn't have sent it back. It'd be like a crack addict sending back an 8-ball. You know, we couldn't have done it. And my My father died the year after I gave him that. And I remember flying back to Pennsylvania to be with my mother and my sister. And I remember mourning the loss of my father. And I knew something inside me as I knew that I was alive. I knew that my father knew that I loved him. And that my father knew that I knew that he loved me. And there was no ghosts. We were even. And I know what it's like to have people die and live with their ghosts. When my grandfather died, the ghosts of the things I did to him, and the ghosts of the things I never said, and the ghosts of all the unresolved stuff between me and him haunted me, until I eventually did what it talks about in the big book and wrote him a letter. And I think that sometimes the amends part of Alcoholics Anonymous is possibly the most important thing we do here, is to clear away that wreckage. You know, in a strange sense, Alcoholics Anonymous was founded on Step 8. Most of you know the story of how Bill and Bob got together in Akron, Ohio at the Cyberling Mansion, Mother's Day weekend, 1935. Bob Smith, for the first time in his life, was talking to a guy that wasn't talking to Bob about Bob's drinking, a guy that was talking to Bob and telling Bob about Bill's drinking. And he had never been anywhere where he identified with a guy's drinking like he identified with Bill Wilson. And he became enthralled with everything Bill had to say, and he was willing to do everything in this six-step, the time the Oxford Group had six-step plan of action that Bill kind of put together, and he was willing to do everything there except the amends. He wouldn't make the amends. And he said, you don't understand. I've almost ruined my reputation in this community. I can't do it. I just can't do it. And he dug his feet in. He would do everything else. He'd help people, prayer, meditation, confession of shortcomings, everything else, but he wouldn't make the amends. And consequently, Bob Smith drank again. He went to a medical convention in Atlantic City, and he came back. He was so drunk that he was unconscious on the train. The conductor had to lay him on the platform. They called his office person who came running down to help him. And she called Bill and Ann. Bill Wilson was living at their house. And they come running down and took him back to Ardmore Street and put him to bed. And he came to on what the historians believe was June 10th, 1935. And he came to early in the morning, sick and shaken, jumping out of his skin. And he said, "My God, what day is it?" And they said, "June 10th. They said, "Oh, no, it can't be June 10th. I have a surgery to perform this morning. It can't be June 10th. Dr. Bob was a proctologist, so you can imagine what kind of surgery it was. It was one of those kind of surgeries. And he's shaking like this, vibrating. Imagine being there laying on the gurney, watch your surgeon come in vibrating it. I mean, that guy, we should build a statue for him, whoever he is. And he couldn't go. So Bill Wilson gave Dr. Bob his last couple drinks and a goofball and sent him into the surgery, calmed his hands down enough that he could perform the surgery. And we don't know what happened to the guy, really. All it says anywhere in AA literature is that the guy lived. And we don't know what else. I mean, we don't know if he whistled when he walked or what. We don't have any idea what happened to the guy. But he lived, and then Dr. Bob got out of that surgery in the morning of June 10th and disappeared. Disappeared. Nobody knew where he was. And Bill was afraid, as I would be, that he was drinking because, you know, he'd given him a couple beers that morning. The phenomenon of craving, all that. But he wasn't drinking. And he came back late that evening, and he'd been out searching out everybody he ever owed amends to that he could find and dealing with all of them. And Dr. Bob never drank again, and thus was founded Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know what would have happened to us if Dr. Bob would have dug his heels in one more time and said, "Bill, I'm not going to do that part of the program." But thank God he did, and we are here. And I sponsor, I get a lot of guys that come to me with sober over 10 or 20 years, and their life is a disaster. They've got credit cards maxed out. They're facing bankruptcy. They got problems in their relationships. They got wreckage that they're creating in sobriety, and they want me to show them a way to fix the problems in their life sober. And invariably, as we go through the steps, and they don't understand what the steps have to do with the financial problems and the credit cards, invariably as we go back through the steps, we will find that there's unmade amends, financial amends, that have rendered them into an unworthy receiver of God's abundance. And so good size. Some of these guys I've watched over the years, great stuff comes to them. And they will find a way to trash it somehow. Because I think I could never fool the God within me. I've always known what I am. I've always known what I am. And I've watched some of these guys start to clear. I have a guy that I sponsored now. He's sober, coming up on 20 years. And for the first time in 20 years, in the last 2 years, he's been digging out, trying to dig himself out of all the financial amends he never made what he should have made 20 years ago. And it's caught up to him, and it's ruined. It's financially devastating. And the guy makes $100,000 a year. And he's got this weird dynamic going on. The more money he makes, the further behind he gets. Because the problem is not... I'll tell you something. It says there's a line in the book that I really believe that's true. It says that when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. And I think financially. I think money problems and sobriety are really spiritual problems. I think any problem I will have starts with my spirit. Is somehow I've created a state of separation between me and me, or me and you, or me and God. And as a result, I start frantically trying to fix my life. And I'm the kind of guy, the more I fix my life, the worse it gets. The more I fix my life, the worse it gets. And what invariably happens is if you fix the spiritual malady, all the other stuff straightens out. We were talking about this before the meeting. There's a line on page 127 of the book that was pointed out to me in early sobriety, because I'm sober about 4.5 years, and I'm sponsoring guys that are making more money than I am, that are more successful than I am. I'm starting to get resentful towards Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, where's my reward for coming here? Right? I've already got the greatest reward I've ever gotten. I hadn't had to sober up in over 4 years. And a guy points out this line on page 127, and it says, "For us, material well-being always follows spiritual progress. It never precedes it." And that's a promise, really. It's a statement of cause and effect. If I will take care of my spiritual business, that the material stuff will follow along. I was 4.5 years sober, and I was getting ready to quit the 9th job that I had in 4.5 years. Get the picture? And it's always the same thing. I get a good job. They seem like great people. I go to work, and it's wonderful. And then it's like their masks come off, you know. And I start realizing how they're taking advantage of me, and they don't appreciate the work I do, and I'm working harder than everybody else, and nobody really understands the sacrifices I'm making. I start building these cases, and then I got to leave, or I get fired because my attitude's so lousy. I'm the guy that they're saying, "Bob, you're a hard worker, but you're not a team player." Because I'm the defensive guy. I'm the guy that Father Martin talks about when he says you walk into any business in the world, you can see the untreated alcoholism. Look for the guy who everybody walks on eggshells around. I'm that guy. And I went to a conference because I was a DCM, and at the conference there was a speaker Saturday night named Chuck C. And I'd heard Chuck 20 times probably. I don't know. I'd heard him a lot. But I never heard him until that night. And Chuck told me some things after the meeting. I heard him say some things when he shared. Then I went up to him and I started talking to him. I told him about my situation and how these people are getting taken advantage of me and how they're screwing with me and I need to change jobs. But I'm afraid, because I'm starting to see a pattern here. And I'm afraid that I'm going to be the guy that's 30 years sober that's had 40 jobs and hated every one of them. I'm going to want to be the guy that hangs out down at the club that plays cards all day and his life's crap. And when he talks to you about going to work, he talks like he's going to prison or something. I want to be the guy like my sponsor and some of the people I saw in Alcoholics Anonymous that when they talked about their jobs, their lives, their eyes sparkled. the people who liked going to work. And Chuck said to me, I'll never forget this. He said, kid, he said, you got it all wrong. He said, what they're paying you, how much you're appreciated, how much more work you do than other people, that's none of your business. You're to go to work for one reason and one reason only, and that's to be helpful to God's kids without judgment. You help all God's kids. You help the ones that are doing it your way, and you help the ones that aren't. You do it without judgment. And he said to me, he said, if you'll ask God to help you set yourself aside and go to work for that purpose and that purpose only, he said, I promise you your life will change. And I started doing that. And I tell you, it didn't take right away. I'm an event kind of guy. I want to say the prayer, go to work, it's great, okay, good, good, move on. And it ain't like that. Spiritual growth is never like that. I go to work, I say the prayer, I go to work, I'm all right for a half hour, then they start taking advantage of me again, you know, and it's, right? And they're, you know, it's back to the same. But I kept at it, I kept at it, and I kept at it, and I'm sitting about 10 months later in a restaurant with a guy that I sponsor, and we're talking about work, and he says something to me that floors me. He said, you really like your job, don't you? And I said, holy crap. I said, I really do. How did that happen? And what had happened is I started practice, what it says, practice these principles in all our affairs. I started treating the people at work like I treated you in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started treating the guys I worked with like newcomers and the customers like newcomers with a helpful of service attitude. And with no time at all, I was running that place, which led to another opportunity to go into partners in a business, in a competition, competitor's business. And I went to work for him and bought him out and never looked back. I sold that company a year and a half ago. And it's put me not only put me in good stead, but my children's children's children will be in good stead as a result of that. And I never tried to get wealthy. I never tried that. All I wanted is I just want to feel as good at work as I feel in my home group. That's all. And I want to change that experience. And I'll tell you something. There's more here than I ever imagined in Alcoholics Anonymous. More than I ever imagined. I was up in Northern California 15 years ago, and I was talking at an AA event, and this guy who was hosting me was taking me around and showing me all this stuff up there. And he took me to this place where there are these trees that were like 300 feet high, that were like 30 feet in diameter. I had never seen forests like this in my life. They were very primordial. I got a feeling like a Jurassic Park kind of feeling being there. It was very humbling, these trees. And we'd walk around these groves and these trees, these forests, and these just majestic trees. And then we got in the car and we're driving to another part where there's more of these trees. And we're going from the one part to the other, we're going through some areas where there's some open fields. And he says, do you notice that there's none of those 300-foot trees in these open fields growing up by themselves? And I said, yeah. I said, how comes that? He said, well, it is their very nature to aspire to grow to such magnificent heights that they easily outgrow their roots' capacity to sustain them, and the roots can't hold them up, and they literally topple over on their own magnificence. And he said what they do, and they must do to survive, is that they will grow up in groves, and under the soil they intertwine their roots into a net at the floor of the forest and literally hold each other up. And that way they're able to achieve their aspiration. And when I heard that, I thought, my God, that's exactly what Alcoholics Anonymous has been about for me. See, I've always desired majestic heights in my life. I've always been the guy that wanted to take big bites out of life. I've always been the guy that wanted more. And this thing in me that drove me, the thing that Father Ed Dowling called divine dissatisfaction, in my own hands alone, destroyed me over and over and over again. And in God's hands, in the hands of a good sponsor, in the hands of Alcoholics Anonymous, intertwining my life with yours, and the guys I sponsor and my sponsor, you've showed me how I can grow into my nature and claim my inheritance. See, it has always been my nature to aspire to magnificent heights. I just would always alone topple over on my own magnificence. And I live a life today beyond anything I could have ever imagined. And I'm telling you, it's not my fault. I didn't do it. What I did, my contribution to the life I live today was I got myself sick enough on self-will to come to a place called Alcoholics Anonymous and be forced by a lack of alternatives to surrender to you because my best ideas were killing me. And I was dying of a thing that I didn't understand, a thing that called alcoholism, a malady of my spirit that affected every single area of my life. If you're new here, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm telling you, you don't. If you traveled around AA like I do, you would realize how lucky you are. You are in a pocket of enthusiasm here. You are within a group of Alcoholics Anonymous that's dedicated to the principles that change guys' lives like me. And I will promise you something, that if you stay involved in your home group and you go with your sponsor and you work the steps as they're outlined in the big book, I promise you that there will come a time in your life where you will look around you and you will find no one in your family, in your neighborhood, in where you work, or even in your AA group that you'd rather be than you. Thank you for my life. Yeah.